Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Preventing Adverse Outcomes in Maintenance Hemodialysis Patients. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Tatar, thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Matthew Arduino has been really quite a big help to teleclass education. He has helped us access some really interesting faculty. He has answered some very difficult questions that were sent to me by some of you folk, and he has often been a sounding board for some of my ideas and isn't afraid to tell me when an idea doesn't sound quite so smart as I think it does. Dr. Arduino is the Deputy Branch Chief of the Clinical and Environmental Microbiology Branch of the Center for Preparedness, Detection, and Control of Infectious Disease at the CDC in Atlanta. He's particularly skilled in outbreak investigations and in the control of dialysis-related disease. He has authored many really interesting articles on this topic. He has peer-reviewed many more and has edited publications such as one at least that I could found that I found was the widely accessed and lauded Biosafety in Microbiological and Biomedical Laboratories. He has been very prolific, and it's an honor to have him with us today. So to present for us, Preventing Adverse Outcomes in Maintenance Hemodialysis Patients from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, it's my pleasure to introduce my friend and our faculty today, Dr. Matthew Arduino. Matt.
Well, thank you, Paul, for the introduction. I hope everybody is having a good day today, and I'm going to start by talking about adverse events that occur in dialysis programs. And I'm going to go to the second slide, and I'm going to concentrate not on infectious diseases or infectious outcomes or questions around whether patients get an adequate treatment or not. I'm particularly going to address issues around chemical intoxication, and those tend to be related either to failures with water treatment, issues related to system design, human error, which also plays a part, and then issues around manufacturing errors. I then get into allergic reactions and then spend a little bit of time talking about our current issue related to heparin. And then talk about non-chemical associated hemolytic events. And lastly, bleeding is the other topic. And we can go to the next slide. And, you know, when you look at hemodialysis around the world, you see a variety of standards and types of equipment that are available to the provider. From batch machines, which are still in use in some places of the world, to our single-pass dialysis machines in providing care. Next slide. So we're going to start looking at intoxications or chemical poisonings. And these usually come from a variety of issues. Either it's failure to rinse the chemical disinfectant or germicide from the dialyzer, or you've rinsed it from the dialyzer, the patient hasn't shown up, and you've stopped recirculation, and what happens is you get rebound of adsorbed chemical from the potting material of the dialyzer, or you get a rebound. And then issues related to water treatment, and this is trace elements in water, malfunction of devices, and then talk about some of the biological toxins in the water supply, which have caused outbreaks, or at least one outbreak, and there was another one shortly after that that we didn't participate in the investigation. And then talk about issues related to dialysate quality. Next slide. So, when we talk about hemodialysis, we usually think about patients who have, large volumes of water, that are exposures during the week, 300 to 600 liters of water per week, depending on treatment and flow rates. And if you take into account normal, healthy individuals who are not in end-stage renal failure and not on dialysis, their exposure could be 16 to 24 liters a week, and that's through ingestion. So there's a barrier. Dialysis, there's only a semi-permeable membrane, and so there's more chances of things getting directly into the bloodstream. Next slide. So I thought we'd start with water, since that's at the beginning of the facility. And, you know, water comes from a variety of sources. So it either comes from a public water supply, so it's, you know, basically tap water that's coming to you. It could be a private supply. And there are even places in the United States that have their own wells. So they're using well water. So it's either, you know, surface or ground waters, or it could be blends of those types of water. If we look at water contaminants, you could basically break them down into three broad categories. There's those that tend to be biological, so that's your water bacteria, your endotoxins, your blue-green algae or cyanobacteria, and it's most when we worry about the cyanobacteria, we worry about the toxins they produce. And they produce both neuro and liver toxins or hepatotoxins. And when we think about other items, there are trace elements in drinking water. Some there are put there by your water provider. And some of those could be things like aluminum in the form of alum, which is to flocculate out sediments before they process the water further for drinking. Could be things like barium, cadmium, calcium, chlorine, and chloramine, which are additives. You can get copper from your plumbing or naturally occurring. Again, you can have fluoride, which is an additive, and there's also some naturally occurring fluoride in some locations. And then lead, magnesium, mercury, nitrate, potassium, selenium, silver, sodium, sulfate, strontium, and zinc are some of the other trace elements that may be in your water because it varies from location to location. Then we have those that tend to be associated or have been associated with outbreaks, and these tend to be aluminum, your chlorine compounds, so chlorine and chloramine, calcium and magnesium, copper. And there are a couple of other things that we'll get to later in the presentation. And then I only mentioned strontium because there's at least one or two reports from Brazil that link strontium to bone disease. Next slide. So if we look at the clinical effects of contaminated water, we see that we can get anemia. It has been associated with, again, aluminum, chloramines, copper, and zinc. Bone disease, again, it's aluminum, fluoride, and strontium. And basically what happens there is those heavy metals then interfere with calcium binding. And even fluoride does some funky things with calcium as well. Hemolysis is caused by, again, oxidative compounds. So chlorine and chloramines, which are disinfectants that your drinking water supplier will add to water. Copper and nitrates. Hypertension has been seen, calcium and sodium have been associated with hypertension. Hypotension, again, these are not chemicals, but it's bacteria, endotoxin, and nitrates. Next slide. We have metabolic acidosis, which is basically caused by low pH of water or sulfates. We've seen muscle weakness, which has been associated with calcium and magnesium. And then again, neurological deterioration and encephalopathy or dialysis dementia has been reported with aluminum. And there have been several outbreaks, mostly in the past, the last one occurring in 1992 or so. And we'll be speaking about that outbreak a little later and a more recent intervention we did that occurred last year in 2007. And then we have your classic nausea and vomiting, which could be a variety of things that could cause that. Bacteria in the fluids, calcium, copper, endotoxin, again, low pH, magnesium, nitrates, sulfate, and zinc. Next slide. So if we look at the AMI contaminants, water contaminants, and the lowest level of concentration, this is how AMI, which is the Association for the Advancement of Medical Instrumentation, the Committee on End-Stage Renal Disease and Detoxification, came up with the water standards. And what they did was they looked at outbreaks and toxicity levels, and then they adjusted their guidance based on these levels. So we know that you can get aluminum toxicity when aluminum levels are at a 0.06. Chloramines, we can see hemolysis when the concentrations are about 0.25. Fluoride, above 1. Copper at 0.49. Zinc at 0.2. Nitrates, as measured in the laboratory as nitrogen, at 21. Sulfate at 200. And then calcium and magnesium, since that is basically a hardness test, at 88 milligrams per liter, and that's actually measuring the calcium component. And then sodium at 300. Next box. If we look at outbreaks that the CDC has been, and we're going to start with aluminum, the first outbreak that we looked at was in 1982. It involved 27 patients. The facility was treating their water only with DI, and they had a cluster of cases. And the recommendations for this problem was to go ahead and install RO and to monitor your DI tanks. In 1992, we had a facility that was using acetate bath. And what they did was install. They had some aluminum housing pumps that were pumping from a storage tank to the treatment room floor, which was up on the second floor, and then filling jugs to take the machines. Well, when they converted to bicarb, the storage tanks became storage tanks for acid concentrate. They did not change the pump. And that what we had was we saw aluminum intoxication in 27 patients with 3 deaths. And what we had, what happened was we ended up, you know, getting rid of the pumps and substituting a non-aluminum containing pump in place. More recently, we had a facility that was doing monthly serum aluminum levels and noticed an increase in serum aluminum in their patients over a short period of time, and in 10 patients, no one developed symptoms. And when the facility went back to go figure out what was going on, is they had a transfer pump in place that they thought was did not contain aluminum parts. The pump manufacturer said, you know, before you use the pump, you test it out on your on the types of chemicals that you're using to make sure that, you know, you don't have any problems with compatibility. The materials that came with the pump did not say that there were any aluminum-containing parts in there, but when you ran acid concentrate through the pump, we got elevated aluminum levels in the acid. So they discontinued the use of the pump and went on to something else. Next slide. And this is just from that outbreak in 1992, which stimulated FDA to send out a safety alert to warn people about using the proper components and making sure that components were are compatible with what you're using. Next slide. And this is the outbreak slide. Now, there are always some sporadic aluminum. We don't see it as much anymore, but there are other sources of aluminum that patients can be exposed to. But this is basically the outbreak curve that Dale Berwin and Lee Bland and company had put together for this investigation back in 92. And when they looked at it, that you could see where we installed the pumps back in October of 1988. And 1989, in between December and January, they had installed switched to bicarb and started acid concentrate. And we see that the epi curve goes up, and the number of cases dwindle down over time, and then peaked again. So that was kind of sporadic. The outbreak ended when we removed the pumps in March. And this actually was published in Kidney International recently. If we go outside the United States, there was a report from the Netherlands Antilles about an outbreak there where they had acute aluminum encephalopathy in dialysis center. And what they had in their facility was a cement mortar water distribution pipe. And there was aluminum leaching from the cement pipe after that was installed. Next slide. So, again, just to go over what's going on nowadays, it's, you know, now that it's 2007, you know, aluminum intoxication since 1992 is rare and sporadic. Most aluminum exposure that we see in patients is from ingestion. Other sources of aluminum include some granular activated carbons, which is why there are you have to know the source of your carbon in your pretreatment. So if we look at the KDOQI guidelines, so the National Kidney Foundation, next slide. NKF Dialysis Outcomes Quality Initiative, they basically recommend serum aluminum testing at least annually in all dialysis patients, and then every 3 months in those who receive aluminum-containing medications. However, the cluster we investigated last year, this wouldn't have been detected if we were just doing annual testing. It may have not shown up until patients had developed symptoms. So, you know, it might be beneficial in some instances to perform routine monitoring of serum aluminum levels as a prevention method. Next slide. If we look at fluoride, again, there have been, in the United States, there were two outbreaks. One was back in 1980, so this is before the U.S. had a water treatment and dialysate standard in place. The facility was doing, this is back in the days where people were just still doing minimal water treatment or no water treatment for dialysis. So this facility, which was down the street from a water treatment plant, basically was doing no water treatment for dialysis. So they were just using city water. And at the water plant, there was a spill of, so they over put fluoride in the water. And they had 8 patients who had gotten ill. There was one death. We basically said to go ahead and install pretreatment and a reverse osmosis unit in place to fix the issues with fluoride. Then in 1993, in Chicago, we had an incident where a dialysis facility was undergoing renovation. And so what they did was they converted a couple of storage rooms into a temporary treatment area with deionization. And what happened here was that the water company that was supplying the DI tanks changed the monitors. And they went from a single light system, which said amber was good, to a two-light system, green being our water's at the right resistivity, and amber meaning that it's not, and to change out the tanks. Well, the technicians didn't quite, that wasn't communicated to the people in charge, and so, you know, they were looking over and said, oh, light's still amber, so we're good. Well, what happened was they had a bolus of fluoride come off these DI tanks, and they had 9 patients who got ill and 3 patients who died because of fluoride interfering with calcium transport. They developed cardiac arrest and couldn't be resuscitated. So this is where, you know, DI tanks, when you're using DI tanks, they need to be monitored by both a temperature compensated monitor that has both visual and audible alarms so that it would raise the signal. Next slide. The symptoms that patients get with fluoride have been reported as, you know, pruritus, burning or feverish feeling, headache, nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea, syncope or near syncope, chest pain, pain in the back or backache, or abdominal pain. So symptoms kind of, a lot of these symptoms from some of the chemicals we see are kind of nondescript and hard to discern from other types of reactions we see in dialysis patients. And then again, the FDA here in the States put out a safety alert to the community to alert people about the potential for DI tanks to exhaust and how they should be monitored. Next slide. In 1996, we had gotten a call from the Brazilian Ministry of Health with a facility that was in northeastern Brazil, and they had a facility where they had a number of patients who developed reactions. There were 116 of 130 patients. Their symptoms were visual disturbances, nausea and vomiting, and liver failure. At the time of our publication, 50 patients had died, and I think the death toll had gone up to about 80 subsequently from that exposure. This was in a little city called Caruaru, which was west of Recife, which is on the coast. The facility did not have water supplied to it, and received water from a tanker truck. And the tanker truck went to the water treatment plant and basically was filled right after the sedimentation tanks at the water treatment plant, so the water wasn't even chlorinated or all the way filtered yet. And then the truck driver would then pour in some bleach into the tanker and then deliver this to the facility. And then unload into their storage tanks and then go back and get additional water. What was happening at the reservoir at the time was that there was a blue-green algae bloom. And we found in patient blood samples and water samples and the dialysate both microcystin LR, which is a hepatotoxin, and anatoxin A, which is a neurotoxin. The facility used carbon pretreatment, a microbiologic filter, and just DI tanks for treatment. And if they had a reverse osmosis system in place, these toxins would have been removed. Next slide. The other things we tend to see in investigations tends to be things related to human errors. And here, this basically can leave you to patient exposures to disinfectants, where we see there was a facility, again, it was they were using a temporary water system, with a DI followed by ultrafilters and they had taken some ultrafilters and put them in line, and did not. These ultrafilters were actually contained a preservative in them, and they were also marked not for medical use. And so they when they started treatment, patients were exposed to sodium azide that came off the filters. In other situations, we had people where we've not adequately rinsed out disinfectant, and we have had exposures due to formaldehyde and hydrogen peroxide. We've had people redesigning their water systems to resize it to get increased flow rates because they're adding more stations without taking into account pretreatment needs. And so we've seen facilities, you know, and in combination with that, using the wrong test kit. For this one outbreak that occurred in Philadelphia in the 90s, we basically saw that they were using a test kit for measuring free chlorine. They had resized their unit, and they were not removing the monochloramine. Their carbon tanks were not sized appropriately to remove the monochloramine, so there was monochloramine exposures. And they really didn't notice this until they figured out that they were having a lot of problems with anemia and patients requiring increased blood transfusions. So this is kind of before EPO, they started using EPO. So, and then the other types of things we still see on occasion are failure to adequately rinse disinfectant from reprocessed dialyzers. And so you get exposure. There have been exposures in the past to formaldehyde. Formaldehyde in the U.S. has really fallen out of favor. And so you see most of these tend to be peracetic acid exposures. Next slide. Here's the sodium azide incident. Again, it was a temporary water treatment system. They had industrial ultrafilters, which were, they actually said, not for medical use on them. And they were packed with 0.25% sodium azide and 25% glycerin to prevent bacterial contamination of the units. And what we had when they put patients on is that there was severe life-threatening hypotension in 9 patients. And some of the others, symptoms include blurred vision, severe abdominal pain. Again, you see this other headache and loss of consciousness. So you see similar symptoms with some of these chemical exposures. In 2000, we had a unit in the States who kind of was having some water treatment issues. They also had installed a acid feed system to bring the pH of the incoming water back towards neutral to assist with carbon removal. What happened was they had 16 patients who developed chills in the absence of fever and hypotension. They also all developed nausea and vomiting. They were all sent to the hospital. One died within hours. And when you asked the people what they detected was they said they smelled sewer gas in the unit. Well, it wasn't quite sewer gas because it wasn't methane. It was actually hydrogen disulfide, and it was more a rotten egg smell. Next slide. And so what we couldn't figure out was, okay, so what's going on? We do know that all the toxic effects of sulfur compounds or sulfur-containing compounds tend to be either through inhalation, ingestion, or dermal exposures. There's no documented parenteral exposures with these types of compounds. And these are all volatile organic compounds. Next slide. So so the hypothesis was we have sulfur-reducing bacteria in the incoming water. That was in the municipal water. They were not. They were using citric acid to to adjust the pH of the water before the carbon tanks. The actual system down the line was not maintained very well, and there were issues with the RO be, actually turning off during treatment. We hypothesize the sulfur-reducing bacteria tend to be anaerobic, and they do, and they can give off a volatile sulfur compounds as byproducts. And what we found in the in the water going to at different taps at the stations were carbon disulfide, methane thiol, dimethyl sulfide, and sulfur dioxide. And we then proposed that those caused symptoms in the patients. Next slide. So, you know, when we look at this, we have an outbreak of severe and fatal reactions in dialysis patients. We had dialysis water contaminated with sulfur-containing compounds. You know, some of the recommendations are if you're going to do acid feed, use a pH controller. Use muriatic acid or HCl instead of citric acid, because citric acid is, remember, it is a food that bacteria can, you know, utilize. You want to make sure that, you know, when things go wrong with your RO, that you take prompt attention and fix that or provide a backup system. And then, again, routine monthly disinfection and monitoring of the water system as well. With regards to manufacturing errors, there are really only two. Next slide. There are only two major incidents that have occurred. One was involved bloodlines, where there was an occlusion and that produced acute hemolysis. And the other one is an incident involving Alfin dialyzers, which were contaminated with perfluorocarbon performance fluid. Next slide. And if we look at the faulty blood tubing sets, this basically, again, was in the late 90s. Rosemary Duffy, who is now with the Ohio State Health Department, was the lead investigator. And it involved multiple states and a lot number, a particular lot number of tubing sets that were produced in Mexico. So what we had were, next slide, when you look at the, these were all blood tubing sets that went on the Cobb Gambro Century System 3 machines. There were three states involved with a single, you know, the product produced by one manufacturer. There are 35 case patients. Two implicated tubing sets of lots were demonstrated to have this occlusion of one particular lot. When we got the manufacturer involved, they went back and looked at the degree of occlusion in the defective cassette, and tubings varied between 20 and 80%. They also estimated that there were about 300 defective cartridges that went into three blood tubing sets, three different lots. And then the lots were recalled, and that ended that cluster. Then in 2001, just after the incident with anthrax in the United States, I actually got a call from the Minister of Health from Croatia saying that they had an incident with a number of patients. And when doing some background information, found that there was that cluster in Croatia led to this recall by Baxter with a series of dialyzers because there was a problem worldwide with these dialyzers. At the time, we didn't know what it was, so they recalled all their the Baxter or Alfane labeled series, A11s, A15s, A18s, A22s, AF150s, 180s, 220s, and the AX 1500s and 2200s. And what happened were patients were started and then became unresponsive and died during treatment. Next slide. The total death count as a result of these dialyzers was over 50. Spain, which had the first cases, reported the first cases, had a total of 12 deaths. Again, the highest mortality occurred in Croatia, which had 23 deaths. There were 4 deaths in the United States, 2 in Texas, and 2 in Nebraska. And then deaths were also reported in Colombia, Italy, Germany, and Taiwan. The culprit was, again, this fluorocarbon that was is used for dialysis repair. And the fluorocarbon, which is PF5070, it was used in the dialysis industry for more than 30 years without a problem. The way they use this, and they use it to repair fibers that fail the initial leak test. So they, you know, they fill the dialyzer with this compound, then they allow it to evaporate, and some of the characteristics of this material is that it's a liquid at room temperature, and it's a gas at body temperature, and it's insoluble in plasma. Next slide. Okay, so the types of things that we tend to see were cardiac arrest, respiratory failure. These patients had severe hypotension, loss of consciousness, dyspnea, chest pain, and abdominal pain, again, nausea and vomiting. The actual cluster from Croatia was actually published in 2002 and is the only published article that's available out there in the Journal of Nephrology, and it's available, the full article is available online there. The other types of reactions we see are allergic reactions. These may or may not occur in clusters. Usually patients are easily identified and respond to changes, i.e. in therapy, or, you know, because some of these are chemical sensitivities to reuse chemicals. So some patients who develop these types of reactions may end up on single use. Some may involve a dialyzer with a different membrane. Some of these are because the dialyzer has been pre-processed before use, and they do respond to, and some of them do respond to things like Benadryl. We did an investigation that was conducted by Dave Pegues and a couple of other EIS officers in around 1990-1991, and we had a report of clusters of anaphylactic type reactions associated with reuse and hollow fiber dialyzers. And we found that there was an issue, again, where part of the hypothesis is that by changing the code with reuse chemicals that were involved was changing the surface characteristics and leaving oxidative residuals on the surface of the membrane, and then allowing activation of bradykinin and the kinin system. More recently, when we look at allergy or allergic type reactions, we basically have events that were first detected in the dialysis community in the United States involving heparin. And we had our initial investigation was to go to a facility, a pediatric facility, to investigate acute anaphylactoid-type reactions in their patients, and then started hearing rumors that other things were happening around the community. The symptoms were very broad. Again, not everybody had angioedema, and we led to this first MMWR, which then also added to a recall of several products from the U.S. Market from different manufacturers. So we had confirmed cases, episodes of anaphylactic or anaphylactoid reaction characterized by angioedema were the related symptoms, which means particularly swelling of lips, mouth, tongue, throat, and eyelids, or urticaria. A probable case had at least two of the following signs and symptoms, which was generalized or localized sensations of warmth, numbness or tingling of extremities, difficulties swallowing, shortness of breath, with audible wheezing, chest niceness, low blood pressure, again, tachycardia, or nausea or vomiting. When looking at the recalled product, oversulfated chondroitin sulfate was identified as the contaminant. This is the next slide after the previous slide. This has been shown to directly activate complement and the kallikrein system in an animal model. These contaminated products have now been found in at least 10 countries. Only the United States and Germany have reported adverse events in individuals, and those events have occurred in dialysis patients and cardiac patients. And there's some data that still says they also may stimulate this oversulf contaminated product also may stimulate the cytokine system as well. Now, these are products from multiple heparin suppliers. There are at least four suppliers that have recalled lot numbers: Baxter, B. Braun, Covidian, American Health Products, at least for the U.S. and Canada, have been involved in that. Research done by partners with FDA and academia have basically led to two publications that were released within the last month that basically show a model for a contact system activation by heparin. The raw materials for the heparin were from plants in China, and they found, when FDA eventually got over there, they did find some issues related with the plant. And there's FDA is still investigating issues related to this. Recently, at least one device manufacturer that has a heparin-coated device has also issued a recall to their users. When we look at non-chemical associated, I'm going to talk about hemolysis. Other than chlorine and chloramines, there are other things that cause hemolysis besides chlorine, chloramines, and occluded bloodlines. You have things that we have seen with elevated blood temperature of the dialysate bath, greater or equal to 40 degrees. And there have been publications, mostly from the older literature in the mid to late 70s and early 80s, regarding this. You really do not see that nowadays with temperature controllers on the dialysis machines. There has been a report in 2006 in the acute setting where they were doing bedside dialysis, where they actually, instead of using dialysate, dialyzed against distilled water and got hemolysis because of that. What we see most often are kinked blood tubing sets and kinked lines and issues related to line kinking while patients are being treated. If we look at hemolytic dialysis events, these tend to be sometimes are rare and sporadic events, so sometimes it's hard to figure out what happened. One, to determine whether it is a chemical exposure or was a line kinking event. So it's difficult to differentiate from all the potential causes unless you have a large kind of cohort that you can look at. And there are all sorts of causes, again, kinking of tubing sets. There was a large cluster of about 12 cases that occurred, I would say, about 3 years ago in Ohio, where the supplier of bloodlines sent the wrong bloodlines for the dialysis machine, and the pump segments were not the right size, and they had some hemolysis associated with that. So make sure you're using the correct blood tubing sets for your machines. Worry about burrs on needles every now and then. And again, with routine testing for chlorine and monochloramine, we hopefully should not have exposure because of chlorine or monochloramine breakthrough. And occasionally you can have drug reactions that can cause hemolysis as well. Next slide. Oop, there's a, that's not. Next, I think that's right. Okay, I think I have a blank slide in there. Next. If we look at bleeding and exsanguination events, there are occasionally incidents where patients do have problems with their access, and this tends to be due to access failure or line separation, needle dislodgement, which is why, you know, when patients are sitting in a chair, we don't like them to cover up with blankets, so you can actually see the access. As a matter of fact, about 2 weeks ago, there was a news article about a patient bleeding out in a facility because, you know, when someone looked, there was a nice pool of blood on the floor because they had a line separation. So we actually are doing a current investigation that involves one of the ESRD networks. So it's a localized area in the U.S. trying to look at determine risk factors for these types of events. And so we're looking at access, what's causing access failures and line separations, and trying to come up with are there any preventive methods we can take. Next slide. The motivation for this current study was basically the Maryland medical examiner, in a review of cases, said, "Oh, wait a minute. We had, you know, in July we had, you know, like 13 cases. When the previous year, 6 years, there were only 24 deaths reported that way. So it kind of, they didn't know whether, you know, this was something to look at or not." And so we figured, you know, we'd help them out and say, look, there's very little known about the epidemiology. Was there something different about this little cluster that the medical examiner had was investigating versus the incidence of bleeding in the U.S.? And then to try to go see if there's additional case findings and figure out, are there preventable risk factors? So what we're doing is using some of the data collected by CMS. So we're using their death notification forms with that providers, next slide, provide to CMS within 45 days of the patient's death, and they can select up to 5 causes of death. There are 2 codes. One is hemorrhage from the vascular access, and the other is code 40, which is hemorrhage from the dialysis circuit. And so we're kind of looking at those among some other data sources as well. Next slide. So we're currently looking at CMS data for the last 7 years or so, and looking at hemorrhage from the vascular access, hemorrhage from the dialysis circuit, accounting for 3.7 per thousand ESRD deaths, with known causes, and when we look at the area that the medical examiner was involved with, we see that for the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area, that their rates are between 5.4 per thousand and 6.5 per thousand. And there are about 1,700 deaths nationwide that have those codes, and it looks like 18% of ESR deaths that are listed are not coded at all or unknown. When looking at the top 10 states for bleeding from the vascular access and death, we basically say see that there it's kind of, you know, there's some on the East Coast, there's some in the central plain states, and so we're currently trying to. Next slide. When you look at these individuals, we see, you know, it's about, you know, 50-50 female to male ratio. Age is anywhere between 28 and 92 years of age. Again, if you look at the breakdown by race, 72% are black, 25% are white, and 3.2% are others. Well, next slide. When you look at the access type involved, again, fistulas and catheters are about even at between 34 and 35%, and grafts seem to fail more at about 50%, 56% of grafts failing. Next slide. When we look at bleeding and access complications, we see that about 20.5% have a documented history of a serious vascular access hemorrhage. 72.6% had documentation of any access-related complications within the last 6 months. That included clotting. 30% had clotting. 27% had prolonged bleeding after dialysis. 20.6 had stenosis. 16.4 had superficial infection at the access site. 13.7 had extensive vascular access infections, 11% had an aneurysm or pseudoaneurysm, and about 4% had graft erosion. So so when looking at this, we're looking at history of access-related problems or concerns. We're looking at anticoagulation-related events. We're looking at psychosocial concerns, and we're also looking at medical errors. So we're kind of, this is an ongoing investigation that is going on, and will probably be presented or published in the future when we get there. When we look at the next slide, when we look at the regional progress on fistula first, we basically see the CMS goal is in the United States is to have about 70% of our patients on AV fistulas. If for the network that we're working with, we're looking at that they are they're improving, but they are down there about one of the lowest for fistulas in the U.S. And there's a trend towards an upward where it varies by network. Next slide. So what do we do to prevent these events from occurring in patients? Follow our standards and recommended practice. Think about your facility and system designs. You know, what's our quality assurance program? We are currently doing an investigation in another state, where, you know, they did where they had surveillance systems in place, but there seems to be a breakdown. You know, we do surveillance, and your report from your quality control meetings is to do more surveillance, and, you know, without someone looking at the data, analyzing it, and then going back to try to figure out, okay, in your action plan, what do we need to do? How can we fix that? Think about inventory control. When we're looking at drug reactions or reactions related to products, nobody records lot numbers. So you kind of have to try to figure out which lot numbers were being used in the unit at the time. And sometimes that's like guesswork. Think about documentation. And then know when to ask for help is another good recommendation. Next slide. So with regards to water treatment systems, what do we do? One of the recommendations is to follow AMI recommended practices and standards. RD62, which is water treatment equipment for dialysis applications, is aimed at the manufacturers. RD52, is the recommended practice for dialysis facilities. There is an ISO document that's also in process that's also looking at a dialysis standard for the international community. With the U.S. standard, we actually have two additional annexes that have been recently added. These include special considerations for home hemodialysis and an annex D, which is a self-assessment for compliance. Again, next slide. Realize that we define our chemicals in water by grouped. They're grouped by three: those that cause adverse effects in patients, those that are potentially toxic to humans when in drinking water, in which case the limits are set at 1/10 the U.S. drinking water standard. So it's a log lower than the U.S. drinking water chemicals. And then there's a third group of chemicals which are not normally harmful, but may be present in physiologic fluids and can be potentially dangerous if present in abnormal concentrations. And then we have defined levels for microbial contamination as well. Our group one chemicals are aluminum, your chlorine, next slide, copper, fluoride, nitrate, sulfite, and zinc. And here are the recommended maximum contamination levels that are allowed in the water. Next slide. Your group two chemicals are those that you have seen are on the drinking water list, but taking either at a 1/10 that level or at the no transfer level. So chromium and selenium are basically at the no transfer level into the bloodstream. And then group three chemicals, we all recognize calcium, magnesium, and sodium, potassium, and these also are components for in your dialysis, say, bath. So that's where you pay attention to that. Excuse me. Next slide. When we look at surveillance, we need to do online monitoring of water quality. Again, test for chlorine and chloramines prior to each patient sift. Test for hardness twice a day. Do online monitoring of your total dissolved solids or resistivity with temperature and compensated meters and audio and visual alarms. Do routine environmental cultures of dialysis fluids at least monthly. At least annually, do chemical testing of your incoming water. And remember that water quality can change over time, and it may be a good thing to test that seasonally to see those changes. Remember to monitor your patients. Pay attention to documenting things on run sheets and flow sheets. Look for pyrogenic reactions and or bacteremia or other adverse events that can occur during dialysis. Again, next slide. Remember documentation. How are we tracking lot numbers of drugs that are administered, dialysate, concentrate that was used, blood tubing sets or dialyzers? Do you have a separate log that keeps track of adverse events? So whether infections or hepatitis or other things that may occur. And next, understanding what a voluntary recall is, and I think this might be more focused on the United States, but FDA can basically encourage a company to recall their product that has a problem. They do not have authority to initiate a recall themselves. So with heparin, what has happened just recently, earlier this week, CMS did send out a blast to all facilities about making sure that they are not using and have removed all the contaminated recalled lots of heparin from their facilities. Next slide. Just to let you know, there are other resources out there. There are email list servers. So there's Renal Pro is out there. There's Nephrol. and I have the addresses where you can sign up to be on those lists. Our division has a rapid notification for healthcare professionals. So when we see something happen, we do an email blast that will go out with a rapid a health alert. There's also free subscriptions available. So for CDC, there's an the MMWR. You can get that free through subscribing there. Other online resources, we do have some dialysis pages. Next slide and last slide. Pages for dialysis. They haven't been updated today, and we're in the process of redesigning. But our guidelines are there for vaccinations and our MMWRs and our several years of the national surveillance of dialysis-associated diseases are there. There's the website for MedWatch and their e-list server so you can get information on recalls. I have a link to NKF Doki, to KDIGO, which is the NKF Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes, the U.S. Renal Disease Data Systems, or USRDS, and a link to the Fistula First program. And I just thank you for listening to me kind of ramble on.
Matt, thank you very much for that. You covered a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And to everyone, thank you all for joining us on this teleclass today. And Dr. Arduino, again, thank you very much. As you covered a lot of ground, and I'm very pleased that you're able to join us.
Thank you, Paul.
Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.